Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. It's Wednesday. JR is to my right. JR, how's it going?
What's up? Broken pins on a Wednesday.
Okay, we're well prepared in terms of writing implements.
Look, it's the same thing I had before.
We don't necessarily have the ability to write anything, but we do have the ability to deliver an awesome show to you because we've got a lot to talk about.
Ominous signs on a JR Wednesday. I don't like this.
Okay, we're gonna get him in. There's another pen.
There it is.
Don't worry, buddy.
There it is.
Okay, so Donald Trump, possible tax fraud. We've got some evidence for you. A little bit later on, climate change discussed on The View. I'd say 3/4 of the conversation productive. We're gonna talk about the last fourth. And then a little bit later on, I had missed this video from CPAC, but you know, a very high profile right winger just apparently threatened to kill or at least beat AOC. So we're gonna talk about that. Also along the way, two awesome guests are gonna be joining us. Farida Nabarema is a pro-democracy activist from Togo who's gonna come and talk about her effort to end the more than a half century long dynastic rule of her country. She's gonna talk about ways to identify if your country is at risk of descending into dictatorship. And later on the show, David Dennis Jr. is gonna be joining us once again to talk about the I would say controversial documentary Leaving Neverland, as well as responding to R. Kelly's interview with Gail King earlier today that went places. It was, I don't know if you've seen any of it. It was really something.
It went far and wide.
Yes. Okay. Well, why don't we jump into the domestic news? We're gonna get to so much of that. One of the areas where Donald Trump has the most to worry about in terms of investigations of his past activities has to do with tax fraud. And it was made clear just a week ago that some Democrats are going to be focusing on that when AOC asked these questions during the Cohen hearing.
Did the president ever provide inflated assets to an insurance company?
Yes.
Who else knows that the president did this?
Alan Weisselberg, Ron Lieberman, and Matthew Calamari.
And where would the committee find more information on this? Do you think we need to review his financial statements and his tax returns in order to compare them?
Yes, and you'd find it at the Trump org.
Yeah, you're gonna wanna call Ricky Cannoli. Think he can help you with some of that. Anyway, ignoring the weird mafia stuff there. AOC is very clear. She believes that there is strong evidence that Donald Trump has been gaming the system to both, like he's really getting it both ways, to get huge advantages from the overvaluing, but then the undervaluing gives him huge tax advantages. The thing is, that may have paid off for him for a number of years, but it might pay off for the Democrats soon. Because very soon after that line of questioning, we're getting more information. Not necessarily specifically about overvaluing, but about insurance fraud that might have been perpetrated by Donald Trump. And that has to do with $17 million in insurance payouts that he got back in 2005 for hurricane damage to Mar-a-Lago. That is his private club and the thing that he loves the most in the world, possibly the only thing he loves. The thing is, $17 million, that pays for a lot of damage. But was there damage? Because according to literally everyone in this case, there was at best minimal damage to Mar-a-Lago, which makes you wonder, what was the $17 million for? Did the company know that Donald Trump did not need $17 million for that? So here's Donald Trump explaining why he got the money, why he needed the money, what ended up happening with the money. He says, on the damage done, landscaping, roofing, walls, painting, leaks, artwork in the, you know, the great tapestries, tiles, Spanish tiles, the beach, the erosion, it's still not what it was. And we continue to spend the money because we continue to suffer the ravages of that hurricane years later. So it wasn't just that it was bad then, it's so bad for Mar-a-Lago, the damage that was done. Some people, the Associated Press, wanted some information about this. Trump declined to provide them with any records about the insurance claim or answer any specific questions about damage at Mar-a-Lago. And you know that something suspicious is going on when Donald Trump won't answer questions about Mar-a-Lago. He loves talking about that place. The walls, the tiles, the cakes. Now, what's interesting is that other people in the area at the time do not recall any significant damage being done by any hurricanes. His longtime butler, Anthony Senecal, said, that house has never been seriously damaged. I was there for all of them. And just 2 weeks after the hurricane that led to the $17 million insurance payout, he hosted 370 guests at Mar-a-Lago for the wedding of his son, Don Jr. Wedding photographs by Getty Images showed the house, pools, cabanas, and landscaping seemingly in good repair. So once again, Don Jr. is gonna ruin everything for Donald Trump. So we have more, which we'll get into, but
okay.
What does your gut say? Is there any chance that he was perpetrating fraud.
Well, there's a very good chance, because also if we talk about other parts of the Cohen testimony, he mentioned how Trump was laughing at times when he got such a payback from his taxes, and he goes, "Can you believe they would let me get this much back?" He seemed to revel in being able to get over as far as getting money back from entities that he doesn't deserve it from. So it goes in line with that, first of all. But then secondly, the fact that there's no cooperation in providing evidence as to why it happened. Mm-hmm. You know, if you have an insurance claim on your car because you got into a fender bender or someone rear-ended you, there's a thing on everyone's insurance that says no matter what accidents you're involved in, do not claim responsibility, because we're here to make sure nobody gets paid. Insurance companies are out to make sure people don't get paid, and they will investigate the hell out of you until they find out that they don't deserve to give you anything that you paid for. So if they're looking to investigate if the claim is real and you don't want to provide the information, that's a sign that you're probably up to something. But for some reason, this guy, his entire life, has been able to get away with these things over and over and over again. And the reason I brought back the Cohen thing about getting certain taxes back is he's so used to it, and people have always allowed him to do it. That's the way he operates now. Yeah. So I do think it has some basis in reality. But the way to disprove all of us haters is to give us the information, and we'll stop talking.
Yeah, just show, you know, you got invoices for all the workers who came in to do all that repair and everything. Very clear, you made purchases of new landscaping stuff and tiles and tapestries and everything.
The butler must hate you, right? He must be a disgruntled employee.
Exactly.
To keep saying all these horrible things about you.
Yeah, well, I don't discount that possibility. Imagine being Donald Trump's butler. That would just be hell. But this is serious. Now look, we have some more information we're going to get to. But I just want to quickly acknowledge, I don't believe that a single Trump voter is going to care about this. And look, the thing is, like, if you try to make the case to people that this guy ripped off an insurance company, many people will be like, I want to. I want to rip off an insurance company. Sure, I get that. He also, of course, avoided paying taxes in a number of different areas. But most people don't care about that either. They don't want to pay taxes. So I get that. It would be great if we could get people to take seriously just rampant criminality. But we've moved on from that. It's not going to happen. Only some portion of the country is actually going to care about that. Still, there should be consequences if you break the law. And I'm just so excited that AOC and her staff are on these sorts of issues. So this is the result of an AP analysis. But I know that continued hearings are going to turn up more and more cases like this. It's going to be an absolute disaster for Donald Trump. I also just want to mention, so more evidence that this was $17 million were not actually spent. The only permits that appeared hurricane related in the wake of that disaster were $3,000 in repairs to storm damaged outer lighting and the vacuuming of sand from the property's beachfront pool. Likewise, records of the city's Landmarks and Preservation Commission reflected no repair work conducted following the 2004 and 2005 hurricane season. So, okay, maybe they spent $3,000 out of the $17 million. What's that, a quarter? So it's still significant. And the thing is, you might say, well, maybe they didn't have to file the paperwork for everything. But it turns out that might actually even be worse. So under local rules, major repairs would have required Trump to request a permit and pay permit fees. It's possible someone could perform such work without permits, avoiding as much as almost $500,000 in fees. But that would have likely been illegal itself. So it looks like one way or another, laws were likely broken. Maybe we'll find out. Maybe he'll provide documentation to clear his good name.
When you have a mountain of illegality for your entire life, it's hard to keep up with it. We've said it many times. So if there's so many things that he can be exposed on, that it's they're like, okay, so fine, you skirted the rules as far as getting something done, and you just took in the money illegal. Then you didn't file, I guess, put forward the repairs that you would have done. Also illegal, and you're avoiding fees. There's always something. So once your excuse comes to light, your excuse is also a bad one, because that was also wrong to do as well. And it's hard to keep up. This can easily be swept under the rug, because people will say, weren't we supposed to be talking about Russian conspiracy and collusion? Mm-hmm. But there's so many things that he's done that are wrong. Why can't we focus on all of it?
Yeah. It's been my position for a long time that Donald Trump breaking a whole bunch of different laws in different areas is more of a problem for him than it is for me. I know not everyone agrees on that. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We come back, 4 ways to identify if your country is at risk of descending into dictatorship.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom, In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
After this. Washington Governor Jay Inslee is running in the Democratic primary this time around with his platform very heavily focused on climate change, which he sees as a good thing. I see as a good thing because it's the single biggest threat facing our country and our civilization. Not Meghan McCain, though. And so when he stopped on The View, much of the questioning was productive about what he would do were he to become president. But she wasn't necessarily having it, as will become abundantly clear.
Maybe I am just a unicorn from another planet, but climate change doesn't even hit my top 30 of how I vote for somebody. So I do think I am on this panel to say this isn't what's selling me on you beating Trump. And I say that with respect. Mm-hmm. What's also not selling me on beating Trump is the new Green Deal, which all of the 2020 contenders have endorsed. Mm-hmm. It would cost $93 trillion, or to every person in this room, $600,000 per each of your households. Do you think that plan, thank you, ma'am, is practical? Or have you endorsed it? Or do you have another option? Because when I hear that an average American is going to have to spend $600,000 for a new Green Deal, you can understand how people like me don't think that's logical.
Well, this is a lot like the death penalties you heard about in Obamacare. Republicans talked about death penalties. Yeah. We didn't have death penalties, and we don't have $600,000 cost. Mm-hmm. This is a thing that I think has been helpful in our discussion in a variety of ways. Number one, we're talking about climate change. That is a value. But we're also talking about high ambition.
Could you give an example to just the average person in here how they can help where it doesn't sound so irrational? I mean, we're talking about $51 trillion, the elimination of planes, the elimination of cows, a railway, no planes. I guess nobody can go to Hawaii anymore. It doesn't sound that rational to me.
It isn't rational because those are the things that Donald Trump said.
The New Green Deal is not rational.
We are not going to eliminate cars. We are not going to eliminate trains. We're going to have what I have in my driveway today, which is a blue GM Bolt made in Michigan with American workers. That's what we're going to have.
Okay, so there's a lot of issues there. The first off, though, is that Meghan McCain, who likes to stake herself out as being a different sort of Republican, she's not a fan of Donald Trump and all that, she is perfectly willing to engage in the same sort of obviously already debunked conspiracy theorizing about the plan if it suits her interests. And so every single word out of her mouth there was stuff that isn't in the plan. We already know it's not in the plan. It's been debunked so many different times. She's got that $93 trillion thing, which is one fantasy study conjured up by a right-wing think tank using numbers that have no bearing in anything, either in the likely outcomes of what might come from the Green New Deal or from the plan as written right now. And when she says, it just doesn't seem logical to me, maybe that should clue you in, that maybe something is wrong about your analysis. $600,000 for every single family in America? What do they think this plan is paying for? Are we covering every square inch of the planet in solar panels? Come on, how do you think that that's actually what's in the plan? And the thing is, like, she is there based on her family history, distinguished American family, that's the, you know, that's the myth or whatever, and there to give expert political commentary based on her experience in and around politics. But she's no better than a random person on Twitter spreading debunked memes.
Whenever those types of arguments are floated out there, you can always see there's a childlike approach to it. So many American families won't make $600,000 at all. Mm-hmm. Ever. So how is it possible that every American family is going to pay $600,000 in taxes for your Green New Deal? It doesn't make any sense. How could you pay $600,000 when you never made $600,000? It's throwing numbers out there, and it still gives it gives credence to the thought that, hey, everybody has access to all this wealth in America. No, we don't. But you're hit with this number of, oh, man, I'm going to have to pay $600,000. How are you going to pay $600,000 when you've never had it, never will? Probably in many cases because of other policies that don't allow much opportunity for people to grow. So whenever they give these numbers of how things don't work and how you're going to pull this off, cows are going to be extinct, there's no more trains, cars, or airplanes, they need to, as soon as someone says it, the next question to that person is to be, hey, I need you to quote me in the quote part of the bill that says that.
Mm-hmm.
Since they're making these accusations, tell me. You researched it. Tell me where it says that. Yeah. Tell me where cows would be extinct. We're going to murder cows, and they're all done. They're gone. She said, no more cows. What does that mean?
Why does she think that we hate cows so much? Cows are delightful. The thing is, like I said, it has been debunked. The thing is, it was debunked, you know, weeks or months ago. Is she really going to remember that? I mean, after all, as you're going to see in this next clip, he denied what she said there. She immediately goes back to spreading the exact same thing. So take a look.
Can I just interject really quick?
Yep.
I understand you're talking the talk and walking the walk, mm-hmm. but a lot of advocates don't. Ocasio-Cortez's campaign spent $30,000 on 1,050 Uber rides. Al Gore's home electricity was 21 times the national average in 2017, even after a green overhaul. Leonardo DiCaprio flies on private jets, including to accept an environmental award in 2016. A lot of environmentalists don't walk the walk. They just talk the talk, and then they want the average American to spend $600,000 in their house. And none of this
adds up. They just said that wasn't really true.
That's what's proposed on the New Green Deal.
Actually, that is not what is proposed. Let's get this straight. That is not proposed in the New Green Deal. Okay.
Well,
I'm going to be real straight about this.
Then I guess, okay. Governor, you've got no problems with voters then.
Well, we do have problems, though. And the problem is that we have an entire half of the spectrum of American politics that doesn't care whether what they're saying is remotely based in fact. That is a problem. Yeah. And look, Trump might be the goofiest example of it. I'm not one of the people that think that he's fundamentally exactly the same as all Republicans. I do think he's uniquely worse. But they are trying to catch up to him as fast as they can. And so, again, she is no better than Tucker Carlson. Oh, Al Gore flew in a plane, so all of the advocacy work he's done for literally decades trying to shift government policy to deal with climate change, I guess it cancels out at the end of the day. And that is what she is paid probably millions of dollars a year. That is the level of analysis you can expect watching The View, that you're gonna have Meghan McCain representing Republicans doing no better than a random person posting on 4chan. And thankfully, he defended himself. But just understand, like, this going forward, we are not going to be able to have the sort of debate over the future of climate policy that we should. We are going to have absurd people on the opposite side spreading obvious lies. Look, turns out it's easy. So you know why I don't want the wall? All the reasons I've said before, and also it's going to cost every American family $35 million. $35 million? How could you support that, Meghan McCain? If we're just making up numbers to make ourselves feel better.
You just wonder what the right approach is, because at this point you have to almost say, when someone continues the same talking point, because Joy Behar had to jump in and say, hey, he already said that, that's not true. Well, it doesn't matter. I'm going to say, so you must not have a problem with voters. No, the problem with voters comes, they listen to those things that you say because they're elementary and they stick in people's brains more than reality. I'm not sure if the best approach maybe should come in after she says that and say, you know what, Megan, I need you to stop with the stupid talking points.
Mm-hmm.
Just call them by name. Hey, we don't like political correctness, I thought. Let's just start calling things stupid, idiotic, ridiculous. Hey, Megan, stop with the stupid points. And then maybe these dumb words will help make people stick with what's actually happening. Because if you speak intelligently and someone else speaks in those types of terms, we know it works.
Yeah, and look, out of all the problems, this one I guess is the least, but it still bothers me that, I mean, we are so far into this. Finally, it seems like people are taking the threat of climate change seriously. And still, if you run with that being one of the central planks of your platform, you will still be mocked on TV. Like, oh, look at this guy. Oh, yeah, I'm sure it's an issue or whatever, but maybe it's not even in the top 30. That's how they respond to you taking seriously this massive threat.
By the way, she was right about one thing. It'd be tough for Inslee to beat Trump, because if this is the main thing of his platform, because of the stupidity of Americans, not because it's his fault, but because enough people listen to these ridiculous things and go, oh, Inslee just wants to worry about climate change.
The willingness to spread convenient lies.
Right, and it works.
Okay, we are going to take a short break. We come back. Lots more to get to. Joining joining us now on the show is writer and pro-democracy activist Farida Navarema. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Very glad to have you here. So I recently watched your TED talk about your effort to bring democracy to your home country. And the sort of organizing theme of it has to do with being able to identify the possibility that your country could descend into dictatorship. For those who might not have seen the TED talk, can you explain some of those characteristics of dictatorships that you've seen in your work?
Yes, we have a few characteristics that are quite similar across the line when you talk about dictatorship. First of all, we have concentration of power, and by that I mean that an individual or a small group of people that are wrapped around an individual, usually the dictator, holds all the power, and all the institutions in the country respond to their order. And by that, there is a full suppression of check and balances, and the state institutions such as the judiciary and the legislative branch are all under the control of the dictator. The second point that I would like to note is what we call generally military oppression, because for the dictators to be able to oppress their citizens, they need a coercive force, and the military usually plays that role. And without the help of the military, it is usually hard for them to coerce the citizens and force their subjugation. Beyond that, you still have a few characteristics that are similar across the line when you are looking into dictatorships.
So I'm curious, you have these characteristics. As you're traveling around, and apparently because of threats against your life, you have to travel quite frequently, never able to stay in one location for very long. Do you see in any Western democracies signs that they might be moving in this direction?
Yes, they actually are. The rise of populism and the fact that people are mobilizing citizens around their political agenda, and these agendas being wrapped around issues that are not really objective, issues that have to do with race, issues that have to do with religion, issues that have to do with different orientations. It is a very worrisome situation, because at the end of the day, you still have a situation where politicians are empowered to dominate others. And we are seeing many Western countries moving toward that populism. But once they succeed at also suppressing state institutions and by weakening them, then they will have the freeway to be able to force their will onto the general public.
In your TED talk, you mentioned that sometimes, or quite frequently perhaps, when the media covers the work of activists like yourself, when they cover life under dictatorships, sometimes, perhaps in an attempt to be helpful, they actually sort of set back the work of the activists or focus on parts of the story of living under a dictatorship that are actually counterproductive, that are damaging to the movement. Can you provide, I guess I'm in media and I always want to do a better job. Do you have advice for how people in the media should talk about these movements and these countries?
Yes, definitely. When it comes to covering the actions of citizens that are fighting against oppressive systems, I always highlight that it is important to put the focus on the work of the citizens, on their bravery, on their actions, and the work they are doing under pressure and the risk they are taking despite all the difficulties that come with being an activist under dictatorships. Unfortunately, what often happens is that the media is more interested in sensitive news, such as covering issues that have to do with political abuse, beatings, killings, tortures, arbitrary arrests and detentions. So at the end of the day, the focus is more on the repression of the dictator, and they use that to advertise the cruelty of the dictatorship. Rather, the focus should be on the actions of the citizens. So even though you want to highlight human rights abuses as journalists, which is a very good thing, you also have to be able to show the bravery and the courage of these activists. And that is the only way we can inspire other people to rally to their causes. Because when the whole focus is placed on the consequences of their activism and the abuse they are receiving from the oppressors, unfortunately, it serves more the purpose of the oppressor because it gives them the ability to show how dangerous they are. And this actually deters more people from wanting to rally for the cause and join the movement.
So you've been working to end this more than a half century of single family rule of Togo. I want to talk about the lives of the people that are doing that. So you obviously, you have a situation where you're extremely worried for your life. There are others working inside of the country. I know there were massive protests last year. What is the state of the movement as of today?
As of today, I will say that the movement has been weakened by the fact that there were a lot of compromise that happened within the opposition parties. And one of the biggest mistakes of the civil movement was to entrust the political parties to discuss the future of the movement. However, there is one unprecedented thing that happened in Togo. The amount of people that rose for a certain amount of time, we were able to sustain hundreds of thousands of people on the streets for a country of barely 8 million people. That was massive. And that demonstration of power shows that the people of Togo are on the verge of breaking free from this 52-year-old dictatorship. So the good thing is that throughout these months of mobilization, we have deconstructed a lot of myths about the regime, myths such as they are invincible, myths such as they are unshakable, and that the citizens of Togo are comfortable with their dictatorship. Now we have been able to deconstruct those myths and to prove that people want change and they are willing to fight for it and they are going the extra mile to get it. Now we are hoping to be able to relaunch the mobilization, but we do know that it took a long time to be able to convince the citizens to get on the street, being able to overcome the fear of repression, the fear of police and military brutality. But that has been achieved once, and we know we can achieve it again. At this point, there are a lot of activists on the run. Many are in prisons, many are in exile, many are into hiding, and that is making it a little difficult. But we do know that the people are ready, and it's all about putting all the puzzles together and achieve the change that we have been fighting for decades now in Togo.
Frida Nabarema, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate you sharing your story.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, David Dennis Jr. is going to be joining us. We'll be breaking down the startling developments being driven apparently from documentaries in the cases of both Michael Jackson and R. Kelly after this. I knew that the new Michael Jackson documentary, Leaving Neverland, had been released when Twitter exploded. That was all that I saw all of a sudden. Extremely controversial with people on both sides. And joining us now to break down why this documentary and what it reveals is so controversial is David Dennis Jr., Senior Culture Editor for Interactive One. David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we tend to talk about this sort of thing, it seems like, historically. And we will turn to R. Kelly in just a little bit. But you wrote an article recently called I Loved Michael Jackson, I Love Us More, talking about your complex sort of emotions driven by this new information. So can you explain what it was like watching the documentary?
Yeah, the documentary was extremely painful to watch. I'm sure it was triggering for survivors of child sex abuse. It was a difficult watch. It was two men going through in grave, disgusting, traumatizing detail about their lives with Michael Jackson as children, about the sexual abuse that they suffered. And I was really taken aback by it. I'd heard about the movie. I'd heard about what they were talking about. But to hear the detail was really eye-opening. And it really sort of changed my ideas about Michael Jackson. Of course, I'd heard about these things. I had was sort of on the fence about it, but I never really reckoned with my fandom of Michael Jackson and his abuse. I was aiding in his abuse in all these years by supporting Michael Jackson, and it really sort of was the catalyst for me to really start investigating how we should treat Michael Jackson going forward.
Now, we've talked before about whether it's possible to separate an artist from their art. And in the article, you talk about your decision, which was, again, painful, to stop playing his music. Why did you err on that side?
Well, you know, I believe the victims. I believe the victims. I believe that, you know, there is some level of guilt to Michael Jackson, and I don't feel comfortable supporting that artist. I don't care how iconic he is. I don't care how much I've loved him. I've loved Michael Jackson. You know, as I mentioned in the article, he's been around since before I was born. Like, you know, I love ice cream. I love pizza. I love Michael Jackson. That's just one of those forces of nature of things that you love. But you really have to think about, you know, who you're supporting. And I believe victims in this case, there have been many more than just these men who have come out against Michael Jackson. And, you know, I have a son who's 6 years old, who's around the age of these boys who were being allegedly abused by him. And I just can't play his music for him.
So that's your reaction. I'm assuming there was probably also a reaction to your reaction, because I noticed that on Twitter, a lot of people, including people that I agree with on almost everything, they point out, as you do in your article, that there's we do get more graphic details of what happened, but there's not much that would classify as extra evidence over and above what we already knew. And some see this as just a continuing crusade against a man who's been wrongfully accused of these things. What do you think about that reaction to the documentary?
Yeah, you know, I cannot force anybody to believe anything. I can't force anybody to believe the victims. And, you know, to contrast it to the surviving R. Kelly documentary, the evidence just is not there like it is for somebody like R. Kelly. With R. Kelly, there was, you know, videos. There were, you know, dozens of people being interviewed. With the Michael Jackson documentary, there are just two victims, really, and their families. So the evidence is not there like it is with other people, and I sort of understand that. I believe them. I believe, looking at the court documents, looking at what transpired before, looking at the voicemail, things like that, I just tend to believe the victims. Now, I understand those who want more evidence, but my problem really is with people who sort of don't care, with people who say that, you know, yeah, maybe he did touch those children, or maybe he did abuse those children, but I'm still love him anyway because he's Michael Jackson. Like, that's really where I'm drawing the line a lot with these supporters. I mean, if you have it in your mind that you believe this man is a child rapist, then how can you justify playing his music or supporting him?
David, this is JR. I think those people that were saying things like that, if you do say, you have to you have to acknowledge the hypocrisy, got to be honest. If you're going to say that you're willing to believe victims, but you're going to continue to listen, or you're going to continue to support. I remember the beginning of the R. Kelly documentary, they mentioned how in history, musicians especially generally, and also maybe actors and big name celebrities would take part in this type of thing with underage women or have partners that were underage and eventually maybe marry them or just did it just for their own satisfaction. I feel like the lines get drawn based off of whether or not someone is with us anymore. How much of a reaction have you been getting from people saying, well, you know, Michael's gone now. We can't get retribution towards him the way that we can with R. Kelly. R. Kelly can still face the music. What is it? Have you seen that type of approach people have been having with this article?
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen a lot of people say Michael Jackson is not here to defend himself. And my retort to that would be, I don't know how much a 7-year-old boy can defend himself. So, you know, if we're going to compare who's innocent or who can defend themselves, that's sort of a dead end to me. Now, when we discuss, you know, if artists are, when they pass, what to do with them, to me, that seems like a cop-out. I mean, I think that, you know, Michael Jackson's legacy is still there. His music is still there. And, you know, you got to think about, you know, if I'm playing this music for my children, and they find out, you know, eventually when they start Googling and they find out what he's been accused of, and if he, you know, there's more evidence that they believe it, they might ask me, why was I playing his music? Why was I supporting him? And I just can't do that.
So in a moment, we're going to turn to R. Kelly. But I am curious, with both of these documentaries coming out so soon, like around the same time, and the reactions being very different to the two. And in the case of this one, I mean, Oprah received death threats. Journalist Yasha Ali received death threats. It's possible that you have received death threats. The reaction definitely seems different, as if the stakes are much higher in this particular case. Does that seem fair?
Yeah, I mean, Michael Jackson is a global icon and has defined our lives and childhoods. I mean, everybody who has watched this or who knows Michael Jackson has a defining memory of him. And so a lot of times our fandom of Michael Jackson, in light of this, is really a reflection of ourselves. We have to look at ourselves in the mirror and look at how we've supported him. I mean, these allegations have been around since the early 90s. It's almost, you know, about 25 years. I had to look at myself in the mirror and think about the ways that I supported him. And a lot of times people just simply don't want to do that. They don't want to look at how they've aided and been supportive of people who do horrible things, who molest children, who rape. And I think that our attachment to Michael Jackson and having to cast that aside is just really difficult for people who love him like a family member.
And before we transition, I just want to say to the audience, because I haven't talked much about this, I watched it and was very uncomfortable about what was revealed. But I'm not asserting that I know necessarily exactly what happened or that I am the arbiter of exactly what he did. But in reading it or in watching it and listening to what they said, there's a lot that you have to sort of get past to think that nothing was going on. I understand that for some people that doesn't rise to the level. I'm just expressing what I feel. On R. Kelly, he was interviewed this morning by Gayle King, and he defended himself in some unique ways. What did you think about the level of emotion and passion that he brought to his defense in this interview?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if he has Trump's legal PR team or what, but that was one of the worst moves I could imagine. He looked as guilty as ever. You know, there was an iconic BET interview that he did about 10, 15 years ago where he asked how do you define a teenager? And that became sort of his, you know, terrible PR moment. And I think this one tops it. I mean, apparently it was an 80-minute interview that they only aired a few minutes of, but he was screaming, he was emotional, he was crying. He seemed to only incriminate himself more by saying things like he beat the case, so he should, you know, you can't give him double jeopardy for multiple instances of rape, which is sort of absurd. So, you know, it was a bad move. Originally, I thought that it was bad to give him that TV time. I will hope that some more of that time on CBS is given to some of the survivors. But I think overall, it only made him look worse in public opinion and sort of secure the fact that he'll be in jail at some point soon.
Yeah. We had a debate when we found out that it was going to happen about whether it was a good idea to give him this platform. In hindsight, though, it seems like it probably did more harm to him. There was one other defense that he brought up, and it's a defense that I've heard of some of the things that Donald Trump has been accused of, where he said, how stupid would I have to be to do X, Y, and Z, to hold these women and all of this, as if you only commit crimes if you're stupid enough to think that you won't get caught or something like that. That to me does not read as a very persuasive argument. Do you think that there are some who might think, well, yeah, it does seem pretty crazy to do all that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seemed crazy for him to film himself with a 15-year-old and keep tapes. And, you know, that, you know, if you look at the comparison of what he's been accused of, and you look at somebody like Michael Jackson, who allegedly had these, you know, these locks on his doors, these alerts when people were coming close, the care that he took to make sure that he had his privacy, and you look at comparing that to R. Kelly, who was, you know, finding women at trial, 15-year-old girls at trial to take with him. You know, like, it is the level of care and trying to make sure you get away with it is vastly different. And yeah, I mean, R. Kelly, the idea of the amount of intellect it takes, I mean, that sort of went out the window a long time.
Yeah, and also just as a general thing, I know many people have made this point, but obviously sexual assault is rooted fundamentally psychologically in sort of a power dynamic, the desire to express your power over people. And just the imagery of him towering above this female reporter shouting and raving and stomping back and forth. I mean, just in terms of imagery, I mean, you were talking about PR. It doesn't seem like that's likely to help his case either.
Yeah, I mean, he looked abusive. He looked like an abusive man who wanted to control a situation. And I have to, you know, salute Gayle for how she handled it. She was, you know, the image of poise, and, you know, she had the questions prepared. She was seemed to be ready for his outburst, his mental breakdown, or whatever you want to call it. He looked abusive. He looked like he was the type of person who would want to assert power over a woman by any means necessary. I mean, you saw really for the first time the type of man who would hold, you know, women captive in some sort of, you know, dungeon or whatever he was doing.
Well, David Dennis Jr., as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're gonna take a short break here. When we come back, what reads to me like at best a bad joke and at worst a threat of violence against a sitting congresswoman coming at CPAC after this. We talked earlier this week about CPAC, and I'm gonna admit, I don't know how I originally missed this. Seems a little bit weird, but take a look at this video from CPAC of Jerry Falwell Jr. talking about guns, cows, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
My boys always had guns in their hands. So we didn't. That's not something.
Hashtag me too.
That's not something you teach them. That's something they're born with. But as far as those cows you mentioned, I've got 100 cows. You just let Alexandria Cortez show up at my house and try to take my cows away.
Yes.
I love cows, Jerry. They're delicious.
Okay, I want to return to Junior there because that was ridiculous. So I have guns. My kids always have guns. Guns, guns, guns. By the way, if she shows up, she can try to take my cows. Am I crazy that's best case scenario, a threat of violence without guns, worst case scenario, a threat of violence with guns. And it's a joke, I know, he's just joking about violently assaulting a congresswoman.
Well, that's the one thing that's a constant. They do always joke about murder. So from people they don't like politically. So sure, like the thing is, there's always the level of plausible deniability you can have. Like, you know, I didn't say guns when I said cows. Going back to the cow conversation, just I dare her to show up at my house. Under what circumstances is that kind of term usually used with, especially with folks who are talking about their guns?
Yeah.
I didn't
to show
say
up
it.
Or and what? And what? And you will sit down and have a nuanced policy debate with her? is that what you were implying there? Or what? Finish the sentence. If you don't want to be PC, if you're being honest, intellectual, dark web, all that stuff, you're going to speak your mind, then say that you would violently assault a congresswoman. Don't just imply it and let that group laugh. He wants to hit AOC or possibly shoot her since he's always armed. He's talking about that. Just pathetic. And also imagine, so sitting on that panel there, you had Don Jr. Mm-hmm. Laughing, ha ha ha. Now look, his jokes were terrible, we'll get to that in just a second. But can you imagine if it was some Democrat saying if Sarah Palin comes, I'm gonna kick her in the face, and Malia Obama's like, ha ha. Like, can you imagine if they had done that? But we have such low standards for Don Jr. that a joking threat of violence against a sitting congresswoman, yeah, of course he can laugh about it. Why not?
Well, we have something to compare it to. We saw how, I think they said Malia Obama, and she's in college now, and something surfaced of her saying, I hate Trump, or I don't like Trump.
That was a controversy.
They went, did you know that Obama's daughter says she doesn't like the guy who consistently calls her father a piece of garbage? Mm-hmm. Can you believe that?
Can imagine if Malia had said, yeah, Ivanka can come to my dorm and try to steal my, like, can you imagine? And just fast, because we only have a couple more minutes. Don Jr., I mean, I can't believe I'm going to say this. Don Jr. makes me hate Trump less by comparison. Don Jr. is, like, I don't think that Trump is charming or whatever, a lot of things that people apply to him. But next to his son, he definitely seems it. Like, that Me Too joke didn't make any sense. Like, it wasn't even like it would make sense to a right winger. It didn't make any sense at all. The I love cows, they're delicious. I mean, and then, by the way, sometimes people will say something or do something and you see it and you learn so much about them. So he told that joke, stupid joke, not funny. And then he looked around with a big smile. Because he has been surrounded by people who will laugh at his stupid jokes his entire life, because that is what they're paid to do. You learn so much about him just seeing his attempts at comedy.
Well, I mean, even the people that were supporting him, I think it's Kimberly Guilfoyle that was up there.
She was too, yeah.
Significant other. And there was even a,
I have to laugh at a lot of bad jokes. Oh, God.
He thinks he's so funny.
And just an awful, like, I can't rule out anything in this country, just keeping it real. The idea that Don Jr. could be the candidate someday is not impossible, but. I mean, I don't think he's got it. I think that, like, look, Trump is a degraded mass of human genomes. I don't know. But, like, you know how, like, when you copy something and you copy it and you copy it, like, it loses something along the way? Yeah, Junior's degraded in some fundamental ways. He's not really a real person, I don't think.
Just look forward to the Trump ticket of Eric and Don Jr. one day.
Yeah. Oh my God.
That'd anyway, be awesome.
While we're denouncing things in Congress, maybe we could denounce high-profile leaders in this movement threatening to assault congresswomen. Maybe we could get a congressional motion on that. That would be cool. We take seriously the political violence that has already been a gigantic problem in our country. No, just the tweets. Okay, I guess. Anyway, thank you everybody for watching. Thank you, JR, for being on the show. Always good to have you here. Guys, we've got so much planned for the rest of this week, so much to get to. Hope to see you then tomorrow morning.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.